Good. First of all, thank you very much for your very kind introduction and for the wishes. It's indeed a pleasure to be here. It's the first time that I visit this inspiring place, and I hope to visit more often in the future. What I want to talk about today is a reformulation of quantum mechanics that I have developed with many collaborators during the last 20 years or so. And the best way to introduce it is to remember what is so striking and perhaps shocking about quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics revealed that nature behaves in seemingly capricious way. Two systems that are completely the same, completely identical, behave in the future in a different way. You have two atoms, for example, that are excited. One of them may decay after 1 minute and the other after 1 hour. There was absolutely no difference between them. This seems to be shocking, because why should nature behave in this capricious, seemingly capricious way? Einstein was very unhappy about it, and he coined the phrase that he doesn't believe that God plays dice. Niels Bohr told Einstein, you should not tell God what to do. And I think that they both were mistaken, because one should really ask the question, why does God play dice? Namely, what does nature gain from this seemingly capricious behavior? And the answer I gave to it that led to this development is the idea that indeed there is a difference between these two identical systems at the beginning, but this difference can be revealed only in the future. So when we do a second experiment in the future that give one result for one system and the other result for another system, we should use this information as an extra information for not only for the future, but also for the past between these two measurements. This is the idea. I can also introduce this idea in another way. As was mentioned here, I like to think about every subject in physics with paradoxes. So I will introduce a paradox that will lead to this development. And here is the paradox. I will try to use these things. I'm not so good at it, but we'll see how it works. I like to write on the blackboard, but I was told that people at the back wouldn't be able to see the blackboard very well. So I will try to use this thing and we'll see how it works. So here's the paradox. This is time. And I have, at the initial time, two particles, one sitting here and the other sitting here. And they are prepared in an initial EPR state, Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen state of their spins. That means that this sum of spin of particle 1 plus particle 2 is equal to 0 in any direction. The particles are heavy, so I don't worry about their quantum spatial behavior. They just sit still at each one at its place, but I'm interested in what happens to the spins. I assume that there is no magnetic field, so the spins are constant of the motion, and they will remain like that until an extra measurement is done. So here is the weld line of particle 1, and here is the weld line of particle 2. And assign time and new time t prime here, I make an experiment and find that sigma x for this particle was equal to plus 1. So I know now, according to the usual prescription, is that I have to change the initial state to a new state that propagates from now on for this particle. And that state is the state where sigma x for this particle is equal to plus 1. But that's not the only thing I have to do, because I know that since the sum of sigma x1 plus sigma x2 is equal to 0, I have to replace that state here with the state sigma x2 equals minus 1. If I were in non-relativistic physics, there would be no problem at all. I would know exactly when I have to do this replacement here. But if I'm in relativistic theory and I look at another Lorentz frame, in this other Lorentz frame, that is the equal time, and therefore I have to do the replacement of sigma x2 minus 1 at this instant. So I will say that from here on, sigma x2 is equal to minus 1. But now I come back to my original frame, and I say, since at this time the sum of the two spins in the x direction was equal to 0, if I know that sigma x2 is equal to minus 1 here, I can deduce from that that sigma x1 is already equal to minus 1 to plus 1 here, even before the measurement that I was doing. I was doing the measurement only later, but if I believe that the description is covariant, the description of the collapse is covariant, then I have to deduce that that information that I got here also affects the past and not only the future. And I should send this vector, sigma x equal to plus 1, not only to the future, but back to the past. And this is the idea that I am trying to advocate here. By the way, I would entertain questions as long as there will not be too many of them so that I will not fall asleep when I'm talking here. So if you have any question at any time, stop me immediately. So far, so good? Everybody agrees with my conclusion? Okay, good. So I'm already on the way to this reformulation. And here is the idea. I'm going now to describe the set of experiments that are happening in three times rather than the usual one that people describe, which is an experiment that happens in two times. Usually people introduce quantum mechanics by saying, at time t1 I prepare a quantum state, and at time t2 I make an experiment to check the consequences of it. Now I'm going to introduce a new kind of experiment, which I think is the correct one for quantum mechanics, and that's a three-time experiment. At time t1, I prepare systems, all of them described by the state psi initial. At a later time, I'm going to do some experiments on those set of particles, but I am going to look only on those particles that at time t2 will end up in a particular state that I call psi final. Now, just to give you an idea of actual experiment where something like this can be done, it's called an exclusive experiment. It's like this. I have here a bubble chamber, and I send many particles one after the other. Each one of them is initially described in the same state, the same momentum state. Each one of them leaves a track in the bubble chamber, and goes out. Some of them will go out in this direction, some of them will go out in this direction, etc. Because of the uncertainties, we can't predict in which direction each one will go. So I will put a counter here, and I will then look. I collected all the tracks, but I will look only on the tracks that corresponded to particles that entered here in this state and ended up going to this counter. So this is called an exclusive experiment because I exclude all the tracks that ended up with particles that went the wrong direction for me. And I have now a new kind of ensemble, which is a pre-selection and post-selection, pre- and post-selected ensembles. The pre-selection is all of them are in the same state. The post-selection is the sub-ensembles of all of those that ended up in a particular final state. Now, notice that this kind of experiment could not be done classically. Because classically, if I start with particles that all of them are in exactly the same initial state, they will all go in exactly the same line. In quantum mechanics, if I know the momentum, I don't know where they go. But classically, if I know exactly the state, I know exactly which orbit each particle will go, and therefore they will all either end up in this counter or not end up in this counter, but I cannot post-select, because the whole idea of classical physics is deterministic. So here we see already something that is gained by this seemingly capriciousness of nature, because what is gained is now that we can have two boundary conditions on the system, and therefore a new approach to time. The new approach to time that can happen only because nature allows these uncertainties is to describe the system with two vectors instead of one, one vector going this way and another vector going this way. But let me show you that this is a consistent way to look at it. Namely, I have to show, first of all, that the prediction in this new way of looking is exactly equal to the prediction of the old way, of the one vector. But then I have to show advantages of this new way of looking that will explain why this reformulation is really useful and fruitful. So let's look at the type of experiment we are talking then. Time t1, I start with systems that are all described by the state psi 1, say. Now, according to the one vector picture, this state is now evolving in time according to the unitary time evolution. At some intermediate time t here, I make an experiment in which I measure some observable A that has complete set of eigenvectors alpha n, such that A times alpha n is equal to the eigenvalue A n times alpha n. Sorry that it went this way, but I hope you understand what I'm writing. Now, according to the usual picture, then, if I find one particular value alpha 1, say, or alpha m, I propagate it now from here to the next time, to t2, with the particular outcome that I got in this middle measurement. And then I post-select only particles that ended in the particular state psi 2. I discard all the other cases. This is this type of exclusive experiment that I discussed. Now, let us calculate what is the probability to get an intermediate result, alpha m, with these conditions. So I have to start with the state psi 1, propagate it in time for the time t1 to the intermediate time t by using the time evolution operator. If the Hamiltonian is not time dependent, it's e to the minus I h times t minus t1 divided by h bar. This is the time evolution operator. Then I select the particular outcome that I'm looking at, namely some alpha m. Then I start now with alpha m, because I know that I have to now a new vector, which is the vector that came out in this measurement. I propagate this vector from the time t to the final time t2, and take the scalar product of this with psi 2. And this gives me a number, let's call this number cm. This number is an amplitude to start with psi 1, getting in the middle alpha m, and end with psi 2, so that cm absolute value squared is the probability to find alpha m, the probability to find alpha m under the condition that I started with psi 1 and ended up with psi 2. Now I do a trivial mathematical change that corresponds to a very different picture altogether. I take this time evolution u here and bring it to this side, namely I rewrite it as u dagger t2 t times psi 2 times alpha m times alpha m u psi 1. This, of course, gives me exactly the same number cm, so I'm certainly allowed to calculate the probability to find any answer in the middle by using this picture. But what is this picture? U dagger is the time evolution operator that takes me backwards in time. So this picture tells me then that if I wanted to calculate what happens in the middle at time t, say when I measure A, what I can do, and I will get just the right answer, to evolve psi 1, the initial vector, as a function of time from here to here, and to evolve backwards in time the vector psi 2, which I found at the end here, and use both of them on equal footing to calculate the properties in the middle. Now, this is a very interesting idea, since it gives me exactly the same answers as regular quantum mechanics. I'm certainly allowed to use this picture, and therefore I can say, look, since this is true for anything that I want to do in the middle, let's forget about which experiment I do in the middle, and just say that when I have two boundary conditions, at time t1 and time t2, the system in between is described by two vectors instead of one. And these two vectors give me all the properties at any time in between of this thing. Now, if I take it seriously, that means that I should look for new type of experiments that will show me that indeed a quantum system at any time between the two boundary condition times is described by two vectors instead of one. No questions so far? You let me go so easily with new ideas? Everybody agrees up to now with everything? Okay, I will continue. Pretty soon you will start to get, you start to worry because I get all kinds of crazy results. So stop me at some point. Yes. What's that? Sorry? Yeah. Yes. No, of course, since I did an exclusive experiment, the sum of all these probabilities doesn't give me one because I discarded a lot of the ensemble. I have to if I want to calculate the relative, this is only giving me the relative probabilities for this sub-ensemble. So there's no problem with normalization because I know that I discarded many of those initial ensembles. So I cannot, when I sum up only for this sub-ensemble, I don't get one. So there's no problem about it because I'm interested only in relative probabilities. Any other questions? Okay, so pretty soon you will start to worry because I'm going to lead to very surprising results. Okay, let's look at a special example of what new kind of physics we should expect. Suppose I take the simplest quantum system that we know about, which is a spin-half system, only two possible states, no Hamiltonian, everything is completely the most trivial case that we can think about. And even there, we will see something surprisingly new. So I start with my spin-half state initially with this state sigma x equal to plus 1, and I end up at time t2 at the state sigma y equal to plus 1 because I've measured and found this thing. And now I'm saying that in the usual picture, I would have said that between these two times, there was only one vector in Hilbert space, which was the vector sigma x equal to plus 1 here. And that result here had no significance for the time in between. But now, if I believe in this new picture, I say, look, my system is now described by two vectors, one of them telling that sigma x is equal to plus 1, and the other is telling that sigma y is equal to plus 1. Can I find some experiment, interesting experiment, that will actually show the difference between the one vector picture and the two vectors? The difference, of course, cannot be complete difference because the two gives me the same results, but intuitively, I will get a difference that will be very interesting. So how can I show that I have these two vectors? One way to show it is to measure either sigma x or sigma y and show that I get the answer plus 1, but that is trivial. If I measure sigma x, I will get the answer plus 1 because the spin is conserved. If I measure sigma y, I know that I can get plus 1 or minus 1, but since I am going to discard all the cases where I got minus 1, I will be left only with the cases that are sigma y is equal to plus 1, so there's nothing interesting here. But what happens if I will measure sigma x plus sigma y? The single experiment that measures the sum of these two. Well, naively, I will say, look, I know that sigma x is equal to plus 1, and I know that sigma y is equal to plus 1, therefore I should get perhaps the value 2. But the minute I look at it, I say, oh, that's nonsense, because I know that sigma x plus sigma y divided by square root of 2 is just the spin component in 45 degrees. That spin component can be either plus 1 or minus 1, but never square root of 2. So my picture seems to lead me astray. I would have liked to say that I both sigma x and sigma y equal to plus 1, but when I add them up, I don't get the answer 2. Something is wrong here. So when I saw this, and of course at first I was disturbed, but I am stubborn, so I did not say that the whole thing is wrong. I tried to think what's going on. Why did not it work right for me? And the answer is the following. If I look at the measurement, say, suppose during this period of time I made my measurement of sigma x plus sigma y. How do I achieve this measurement in the laboratory? I don't do it, but I'm a theoretical physicist. But how would the experimentalist do it? He will introduce an inhomogeneous magnetic field in this direction, like a Stern-Gerr experiment. What does this inhomogeneous magnetic field do? It precesses the sigma x around the 45 degrees, it precesses the sigma y. So that means that in between, during this measurement, both information that I wanted to check, that sigma x is equal to plus 1 and sigma y is plus 1, are lost because my measurement disturbs both vectors. When I have just a single vector, I can always find the measurement that doesn't disturb it if I measure something for which this vector is an eigenvector. But when I have two different vectors like this, I can never find the measurement that will not disturb at least one of them. That means that as long as I do the usual type of measurement, there is no way to see the two vectors. So I was searching for some way to to have the cake and eat it. Namely, some way to find the measurement that will give me information and nevertheless would not disturb at all the system. And surprisingly, there is such a measurement. There is a very interesting limit that people did not notice, and the limit is the following. When I do experiments on many, many replicas, so I can get from each one of them small information, collect all the whole information. Suppose the information that I get from each one of them is proportional, is epsilon is proportional to, say, 1 over n, where n are the number of particles that I will make the experiment on. So epsilon is a small number. I need to collect the information from all the n particles to get the result I'm interested in. The question is, what disturbance do I do to each one of these particles? The surprising thing is that the disturbance on each one of these particles goes as epsilon squared. Therefore, when epsilon is sufficiently small, I can find all the information that I like without even disturbing one of the particles. This suggests that, in fact, as I will show you now, it's possible to check all the predictions of quantum mechanics without ever encountering a single collapse. Let me show you how it works. First, I want to show you an interesting mathematical property in Hilbert space that I'm surprised that you don't see it in every book. If I look at any operator A and apply to any vector psi, I know that I can write it as this is equal to some new vector psi prime. Every vector can be written as a sum of a coefficient times this vector plus another coefficient times an orthogonal vector. This is a general property in any vector space. So I can write this as A times psi plus B times some orthogonal state to psi. And I, since I'm free to choose any phase that I want on this orthogonal phase, I can make this B being a real number. You will see in a minute that A also is a real number. So what are A and B? Let me prove to you that they are very interesting quantities. Let me multiply A psi by psi. So I have psi times A psi. And this term will not be there because psi of psi orthogonal gives me zero. So this is simply equal to A. So A is what we usually call the average of A in this state. But remember, see now that it's not a statistical property, it's a geometrical property. Now, what about B? Let me multiply the state A psi by itself. So I take A psi times A psi. And I see that this is equal to A squared plus B squared, looking on this side. I bring A in this to here because it's an omission operator, and here I see that this is equal to the average of the square of A, because it's psi A squared psi. So from this I see that B squared is equal to the average of the square of A minus the square of the average, and this is indeed delta A squared, the uncertainty of A. So I have this general nice theorem that A times psi, any vector A, any operator A times any vector psi is equal to the so-called average of A, but now it's just a mathematical property, psi A psi, times the state psi, plus the uncertainty of A, the so-called uncertainty of A, times the orthogonal state of psi. But no statistics involved here. This is just a mathematical property of vectors in Hilbert space. I'm going to use this property now to prove to you the general theorem that I said, that there is a limit where I can make a measurement of anything that I like without disturbing any quantum system. So suppose I have an ensemble, psi total, it will be an ensemble of n, n systems or n particles that are all described in the same state. So psi n is the same state for particle n, say. And now I look at the operator that I call A total, which is defined to be the sum of the individual A divided by n. This is still an operator that acts on the whole system. I want to prove now that A total times psi total is equal simply to the average of A for each individual particle times psi plus a correction delta psi that goes to zero when n goes to infinity. That means that if I make a measurement of this operator at the limit for a large enough ensemble, I get for any operator just a definite number without even disturbing a single particle, because I leave the state unchanged. And the reason for that is that the interaction to each individual particle is proportional to 1 over n, and therefore the probability for disturbing it goes as 1 over n squared. And therefore 1 minus 1 over n squared to the power n, this still goes to 1. That means that all of them are left without change, and I make a measurement of this quantity, gives me the value of A average. So now I'm in business, because I can prove to you now that I can check any property of any quantum system without disturbing it at all, provided I have enough replicas. What happened? Oh. Okay, that's better. That's your first question then. Okay, so for example, suppose I have a particle described by psi of x. What does the usual dictum of quantum mechanics say? In order to find psi star of x at any point times psi of x, I have to make measurement of x on many, 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 many particles, and I calculate how many of them happen to be falling this number in this position, in this particular position. That will give me psi star of psi. Very disturbing measurement. Lots of collapses all around. But I'm saying instead, if I have enough replicas of this, and I need enough of them because in order to calculate probabilities, because I need to repeat this experiment many, many times, instead of doing this experiment, I will simply make an experiment where I will have a single measuring device that measures the 1 over n times the sum of the projection operator around the position x1 for all the particles. I've shown to you then that this thing will give me the average of pi n, so therefore it will give me indeed the value of psi star of x1 times psi of x1 without causing even a single collapse. So here I'm telling you now that it's possible to speak about reality in the quantum domain, because usually people say there is no reality in the quantum domain, because each time you come and make a measurement, you necessarily disturb what you are looking, and therefore you don't find what was really there. But I'm telling you that since anyhow, in order to check the predictions of quantum mechanics, we needed ensembles, why don't we use this ensemble and make measurements that don't disturb the system at all and see what is really there without any disturbance? This is very disturbing statement. You still let me go without stopping me. I'm changing what everybody believes about quantum mechanics, and nobody's daring to tell me that I'm stupid or fool or something. Come on, ask some questions. Where are you? I'm not going to continue without a few questions. All right. Yes, first one, yeah. I can't hear you, so you.
You've shown that we can measure properties of infinite ensembles without making any disturbance, but can we do this with finite ensembles as well?
Which is what we have. Say it again.
So in real life, we have finite ensembles rather than infinite ensembles.
If I have only a finite number, mm-hmm. then I can also not check the probabilities, because I can check the probabilities only up to some uncertainties of the order of square root of n. So I will make my measurement also with that kind of accuracy, and then I will still not disturb it. So I'm allowed to have some uncertainties in my measurement if I have only a finite number, so I will not disturb any one of them, provided I don't get the exact information. But I'm speaking really in the limit when you have really enough particles so that you can really do this kind of weak measurement. Let me perhaps mention that all the measurements that we do in everyday life are actually this kind of measurement. For example, if I look at this table, and I see this nice shape and everything, and I think, what actually happened here? What I see is lots of photons coming and reflect from the table. Each photon has a wavelength that is very, very large compared to the separation between atoms. So each photon interacts with a large number of atoms, and therefore it makes very weak interaction with each one of them. So what I see is actually a weak measurement, which gives me an average property or collective properties of many, many atoms. And all the experiments that we do in the macroscopic world is classical in nature, not because the thing is heavy, but because we do experiments on many quantum particles, and the experiments interact very weakly with each one of them. So in fact, all what we see around are examples of weak measurements. And that's why we have the classical domain, not because in classical system we have heavy particles, but we have the protection, how do you call it, the protection in many. There is another expression for it. Yeah, okay. Then. Any other questions?
I have a question. Your operator A that you're using to make a measurement on the system, and it's
the sum of the A total?
Yeah, the sum of the A's yeah. over N. So, I mean, you said that you're making a measurement on the system without causing a single collapse, but aren't you still causing a collapse on every single little particle?
No, because I've shown that I'm left with the same state initially plus a correction delta psi. In fact, I have not shown it, so let me finish the proof. Okay. I did not prove it. Okay. In a minute, thanks for asking, because I did not finish the proof to show that indeed the sum of AN times psi total gives me indeed just average times total with no change. Then it will be no collapse, okay? So let me finish my proof. Okay, I want to see what happens when I take 1 over n times an and multiply it by and apply to the psi total. So when a particular an acts on psi total, it produces a change in psi total. And what is the change? An times psi total will be a product over all m different from n that are still remaining in the initial state. The initial state was psi m, and with the particular n state was changed into, let me write what happened when I applied a n to psi, or a, yeah. If I apply a to psi to the particular individual psi, I use my theorem that a n times psi, the particular psi of the particle n, was equal to a average for the single times psi n plus delta a times psi n orthogonal. So therefore, I can say that an times psi total is equal, first of all, to a average times psi total. That's from this contribution, plus delta A times something that I will call psi total orthogonal for particle A. So now, when I take that sum and I look at what happens if I apply A total times psi total, I get, first of all, n times the same contribution from A average, so that cancels that N, so I get A average times psi total, plus something that I will call delta psi. And let me see now that delta psi goes to zero. Delta psi is equal to 1 over N times delta A for the individual particle times sum over N of the thing that I call psi orthogonal for particle n. Now notice that these states are orthogonal to each other, because for each different n, I took another particle to an orthogonal state. So these are all orthogonal states to each other. Therefore, if I look at delta psi absolute value square, that is equal to delta a square divided by n square and multiplied by n, because these things give me contribution only when I multiply psi orthogonal by itself. And therefore, this is equal to delta A square for individual particle, that's finite, divided by n, and therefore it goes to zero when n goes to infinity. So n is sufficiently large, when I do this experiment, I am left with the original state for all of them, therefore that not even one has changed. This is the proof when n is sufficiently large. This kind of measurement does not change even a single particle. That's very surprising. So we have a new kind of measurement, weak measurement, that can show us all the information about quantum systems without disturbing them at all. New kind of reality. Now, sometimes it's not convenient to take the whole ensemble, and instead we would like to make the measurement by interacting separately with each particle with different measuring device and still collect all the information. So what I have, for example, I have an ensemble where one particle here and another particle there, etc. Each one of them have the same state apart from this trivial translation. Here I have measuring device number one, here I have measuring device number two, measuring device number three, etc. So each measuring device interacts extremely weakly with each particle, so the change in the pointer of this measuring device, the change in the measuring device is very small compared to the uncertainty. For example, if I write a coupling that is proportional to the position, then there is a shift in the momentum of each measuring device that is very small compared to its uncertainty. But if I collect all the momentum later, sum them up, they give me exactly the same information that I had before. So it's very important to realize that it's possible also to do these experiments by different measuring devices interacting very weakly with each different particle. I'm going to use this now in a new way. Okay, so now comes the real news. Up to now, it was interesting that I can do this kind of measurement, but now comes the big surprise. Remember that I interacted very weakly with each particle, and therefore I can do something like this. I can look at the result that I got, which is the average of A. That was the answer that I got by collecting all the particles. And now I'm going to do the following thing. I'm going to introduce a complete set of vectors and sum over them. This, you know, this is a unit operator. The sum over n of phi n is a unit operator. So this still is equal to the average of A. Sorry? Ah, okay. Maybe I should rotate myself. Okay, now. Thank you. now let me do another trivial thing. Let me write here psi phi n and multiply it by phi n psi and divide by phi n psi. So I have here phi n a psi divided by phi n psi. This is still equal to the original average of A. And remember, I'm summing all the time over n. So I'm saying the following. Look, I start with an ensemble of particles that all of them are described by the same state psi. I made my weak measurement, and I got the average of A. But since it was a weak measurement, and I could have done it to each particle with another measuring device, I can post-select all the particles that will end up with phi 1, all the particles will end up with phi 2 if I make measurement of phi at the end. This gives me the probability to find the final state phi n. And this gives me a new kind of strange number. And the claim that I'm making now, and you can prove it to yourself, but it's obviously even from this, is that this new number that I call the weak value of A is the outcome of a measurement, weak measurement that will be done on a particle that start with the state psi and ended up with the state phi n. So I have a new kind of quantity that corresponds to this new type of experiments that are pre and post selection that I call A weak. So A weak is defined to be a property of the observable A and particles that have been pre-selected and post-selected. So if I have a particle that was pre-selected in the state psi 1, and post-selected in the state psi 2, and in between there was a weak measurement to measure the operator A, then the answer will be this quantity divided by psi 2, psi 1. Let me give you another proof that this is indeed what happens in weak measurement. And the proof goes like this. If I want to introduce what happens when I make a measurement, one way to look at it mathematically is to use the time evolution that was suggested by von Neumann. If I have a measuring device that is described by the state phi, and I have a system that is described by the state psi, I can look at the time evolution, or unitary operator, e to the iq times a. This is the displacement operator. Q is a variable of phi, and A is a variable of psi. So suppose psi is an eigenvector of A, so I will have a number here, and then it will be a displacement operator on the momentum of phi, which I will call the pointer, by the value of A. If it's a strong experiment, then indeed the displacement for each different eigenvalue of A will be large compared to the uncertainty of momentum for the pointer of phi. But suppose I look at the other extreme, when I look at a very weak coupling, e to the I lambda QA, where lambda is so weak that I can take just first order in lambda. So then I can rewrite this as 1 plus I lambda Q times A. And now I assume that I forgot that this is not remaining there, so each time that I remove it. So it's not like a blackboard. Okay, so suppose now I look at psi 2, this is my post-selection, e to the I lambda QA, very weak measurement, times psi 1, and times phi. So when I sandwich this thing between psi 2 and psi 1, I am left with the effect on the measuring device phi due to this interaction. And I'm taking now only first order, so I have psi 2 times 1 plus I lambda Q A times psi 1. So this I can rewrite as psi 2 psi 1 times 1 plus I lambda Q times psi 2 A psi 1 divided by psi 2 psi 1. And this is the weak value, and since this is small, I can rewrite it as this is just an amplitude to get the initial and final state, that's just a number, but the dependence on Q will be e to the I lambda Q times A weak, where A weak again is this thing that I told you before. What? Yeah, this all acts on phi, of course. This all is acting on phi. This is all, I'm collecting that thing that is supposed to be still an operator that acts on phi. I'm left here with an operator, which is e to the I lambda Q A weak, and that's supposed to act on phi, and it will therefore shift the momentum of phi by the value of A weak, rather than by one of the eigenvalues, yes? Okay, so now let's examine this new kind of animal, this new weak value. It's a very strange animal indeed. So I claim now that we have a new kind of quantity in physics that we will get in every measurement if the interaction is sufficiently weak and the system that we measure is being pre-selected and post-selected. So let's look carefully what this new quantity is like. Here, this is a very, very interesting new quantity. Psi 2, A, psi 1, divided by psi 2, psi 1. First of all, you can immediately attack me and say, look, you're stupid. You're talking here about a quantity that is not real even. How can you say that the result of a measurement could be an answer which is complex, not even real? Well, luckily, there is a way to understand it. And here is the way. In classical physics, if I say that x goes to x plus I, x zero, then I really leave my space and it has no meaning at all. But in quantum mechanics, if I have a wave function e to the minus x squared over delta squared, and I'm saying, look, I move x now to x plus ix0. So that means that my state will move up to normalization, which I always have to take care of later, to x plus ix0 squared divided by delta squared. And now I look at it carefully and say, oh, I have this vector is still in Hilbert space, so there is a meaning to what's going on here. And in fact, the meaning is that this thing, a path of normalization, goes to e to the minus x squared over delta squared times e to the I, or 2, yeah, suppose it's 2 here, e to the I x, x0, times a normalization factor that I don't worry about, because I have always to normalize my Clean post selected ensemble. So what is this? This is simply a shift, not in position, but a shift in momentum. So that means that when I do a weak measurement and I find a weak value which is not real but imaginary, my measuring device will act in a sensible way. Instead of the pointer, the momentum shifted, the pointer position, or vice versa, depending on what happens. So there is a meaning even to a complex thing. Another interesting thing about this thing is that it can be, give me answers that are extremely large. Suppose A is a bounded operator, say a spin operator. By making psi 2 and psi 1 nearly orthogonal, I can make this amplified as much as I like. So this suggests that by doing the correct, the proper pre and post selection, by making the pre and post selection nearly orthogonal to each other, I can get situation where I will have a huge amplification. This actually has been done now by a number of experiments. Again,
can I ask a question?
I will not continue without questions, because yeah. I am telling you so many crazy things and nobody answers to me.
Yeah, there's something I don't understand. So your formula wouldn't work if psi 1 and psi 2 are indeed orthogonal, right?
No, they are nearly orthogonal. They were never orthogonal because then this is set of measure zero. Never, don't worry about set of measure zero.
Yeah, no, so the part where I'm confused is that...
What?
The thing that confuses me is that if psi 1 and psi 2 are wave functions of infinitely many particles, and I just I do a very slight change in any of the particles, the overlap in the limit is always zero. You get the orthogonality catastrophe.
Yeah, you have to be very careful in the pre and post selection when they are very close to each other. You have to do measurements that are very exact. Otherwise, you can get big changes. But what happens if you have some uncertainties in the post-selection? Remember then that you average over them and you still get a sensible thing. Because if you will look at articles, we wrote an article in which we say that we have a pre-selection of some state and post-selection that has some variation in it. So then you can average over possible weak values and get the correct answer according to this mistaken. So there is a way to handle also this sensitivity. And we wrote an article about that. But that's a good question. Any other question?
Well, this goes back a little bit. You claimed that you never needed to do a measurement in the normal, in the disturbing sense.
I could not hear it.
Oh, you implied that we can get by with thinking of only measurements that do not disturb the system that's being measured. But part of your input was an assumption of an infinite ensemble or a very large ensemble of identically prepared systems. So have you thought through how you would create such an ensemble? Because one way, a typical way, is to do a separate measurement, like pass it through a polarizer on each
individual
system. For
some reason, I can't hear you. Maybe somebody can tell me what the question is. Can you? I can't follow you. Can somebody else say
I can leave the question until the end. It goes back. You seem to claim that we didn't need the normal concept of measurement which disturbs the system. Did I understand correctly?
For some reason, I can't follow something the point says. Can somebody from close by tell me what the question is?
So the question was, did you claim earlier that we don't need the concept of a measurement that disturbs the system? That one
what?
Can do without the concept of a disturbing measurement.
Something is wrong with my hearing. okay, say it slowly, all right?
Why don't you go up and ask
Ah, okay. We need strong interaction, right? Yeah. Okay, what's the question?
You said that you didn't need the concept of a disturbance measure.
No, I just say that I can test all the
right.
all the predictions of quantum mechanics with weak measurement. Of course, I need in the beginning and the end the collapse idea, but in fact, I can deduce what the probability of the collapse will be also by weak measurements. So I even that I only need in order to test all the predictions of quantum mechanics. I only need one thing. I have to that if I do a strong experiment and I repeat it immediately, I will get the same answer. That plus the dynamics of quantum mechanics, Schrödinger equation, give me all the predictions of quantum mechanics.
Okay, but in particular, you need an ensemble of many identically prepared systems.
Yes.
And it might be that some sort of collapsing measurement is involved in the preparation of the ensemble.
What do you mean, some collapse? Of course, I told you, when I prepare the ensemble, I need a collapse, of course.
Okay.
But I don't.
Yeah,
okay, fine. No, what I meant is that you're given an ensemble. And you're told that all of them are pre-selected according to the usual rules and post-selected according to the usual rules. Can you then check all the predictions by only by weak measurements? And the answer is yes. And you will get also these new kind of weak values. Okay, any other questions?
You are showing all of your calculations in standard quantum mechanics. Could you comment on what an alternate formulation might look like where you treat your two states as real, where you double your Hilbert space size?
To that when I will speak about generalization of quantum mechanics, which will come at the end, hopefully at the end of this talk. Any good newer formulation not only gives you some new insights and some new effects, but also some way, very intuitive way to generalize quantum mechanics, and I will discuss this in a few minutes. Any other questions?
Was there another question over here somewhere?
Okay, he gave up. All right, so now let's come to some examples how to use this new kind of insight. The first is the so-called three-box example that I invented. You have three boxes, and you start with a single particle that is shared equally by these boxes, namely in the state psi 1 plus psi 2 plus psi 3, where psi 1 is totally localized here, psi 2 here, and psi 3 here. Let's assume that they are all in the ground state of these boxes, so there is the only freedom is in which box the particle is. So this is the initial state. Let's do it now in time. The initial state is psi 1 plus psi 2 plus psi 3 for the three boxes. The final post-selected state, this is the state T1. The post-selected state at time T2 is psi 1 plus psi 2 minus psi 3. And since those are eigenstates of energy, there is no change in time. This state remains constant, this state remains constant. And I ask now, what happens if I do experiment in the middle? Which kind of experiment? One possible experiment, this is the intermediate time, is to open one of the boxes and see whether the particle is there or not. And now, big surprise, if I open this box in the middle, I am sure to find the particle there. Because if I don't find the particle there, I am left with this state coming from here, which is psi 2 plus psi 3. And the state here is psi 2 minus psi 3. These two are orthogonal, so this is impossible. So therefore, if I open only this box and look there, I am sure to find the particle there. But if instead I were to open this box, I am sure to find the particle there. Because again, this state is orthogonal. This state is orthogonal to that state. So what's going on here? I'm sure that I find the particle here, and I'm sure if instead I would open that box, I would find the particle here. After all, I have only one particle. So how can I say that there is a particle here and there is a particle there? The usual conventional answer to this type of paradox is to tell me, don't speak about measurement that you don't do. Asher Peres, the late Asher Peres, said that he would like on the stone where he is buried to be written unmeasured observable don't have values. He wanted this to be his dictum, okay? And in other words, to say, don't speak about counterfactual statement. Counterfactual statement or statement about measurement that you have not done. Because if you would really do the measurement, you will immediately see that if you open this box and look and indeed find the particle there, you cannot anymore deduce that the particle is here because that measurement did exactly disturb that state that is necessary in order to deduce that the particle is also here. Therefore, opening both boxes will disturb each other and you will not know anymore that there is a particle here and a particle there. Therefore, the statement here is don't speak about measurements that were not done. You're wasting our time. This means nothing. But now we have a new kind of tool, and that's weak measurements. In weak measurements, I can measure this, and I can measure this, and the two things don't disturb each other. So I come with my measuring device that measures very weakly this thing, and I find indeed one here. And I do with another measuring device, I measure weakly how many, if there is a particle here or not, and I find indeed one. But altogether, there is one, therefore my weak measurement here must give me the value minus one. Now, what does it mean to make these weak measurements? For example, suppose I have a very rare pre- and post-selected ensemble, and particles that all of them started here, and all of them ended up here. Don't worry about the fact that this is exponentially rare thing. It can happen. Then I know that there are, according to weak measurements, there are n particle here, n particle here, and something that's minus n here, which at first doesn't make any sense at all. Now, how do I do weak measurement on a situation like this? I cannot open and count because that is a strong experiment. So to make a weak measurement, I have to find a way to measure how many particles there are, say, in this box, with a measuring device that interacts very weakly with each one of them. Well, we know how to do it. For example, if all these particles are charged, I will take just a single charged particle here and see what kind of electric field it feels. It interacts very weakly with each one of them, but with n of them, it will really be pushed here, and I will be able to tell what is the number here up to some uncertainty of the order of epsilon times n. So this is a very good measurement that will tell me indeed that although I interact quickly with each one of them, there are n particles here. I have another charged particle here that also tells me that there are n particles here. And what happens if I put a charged particle here? Although it has the same charges, it actually is attracted. The minus one here means that this particle here act as if they have the opposite properties of normal particles. That is the minus one meaning here. So this is a very interesting new situation. I don't interpret the minus one as a negative probability, because negative probability doesn't make sense. You can't have negative numbers. Probability is just counting how many times you have it. But I interpret negative weak values as saying that particles that have negative values, weak values, are particles that behave in the opposite way to normal particles. In fact, if you check by weak measurement, this particle will have negative mass, they will produce gravitational field in the opposite direction, they will have negative inertial mass, they will have opposite charge, everything will be opposite to normal particles. So it's not like antiparticles, because antiparticles have positive mass. This is a new kind of animal, beast. I don't know yet how to call it. I thought about phantom particles, but then phantom would mean that it's not really there. So maybe weak gluons or weak particles. I am open for suggestions how to call this new kind of particles that have the opposite particles to normal one. Or positons, I don't know. Any suggestion from here? How to call these crazy particles? Particles that have the opposite properties to normal particles in all respects. Okay, come with suggestion. I'm here till Sunday. I will give credit to anyone who comes with a good suggestion. Okay, this was example number one. Now, example number two is something that got a lot of excitement recently, in fact, with experiments that was done nearby here. And it's connected with a paradox that was invented by one of the people at Perimeter, which is called the Hardy paradox. So let me show you what is the idea there, how to use weak values to solve this paradox in an interesting way, not in a trivial way. What is the paradox? It starts with an idea that's called the interaction-free measurement, or the measurement on a bomb that was invented by two students of mine, Avi Elitzur and Lev Weidman. It goes like this. You have Mach Zehnder. You send a photon here. There is half half reflecting mirror, so it's split into one half here and one half here. Regular mirrors here. And then again, half reflecting mirror here. So you know that the photon must come in this direction, or in this direction. It doesn't matter, depending on the optical length here. Now, the idea was to say, suppose I put here a bomb, dramatic thing, bomb. The bomb has the property that if photon touches it, it immediately explodes, for sure. So now I send my photon here, and I see that it can come, of course, also here, because I know that it did not explode, so the photon must have gone this way. But if it goes only this way, then it has equal probability to end up here and end up here. So therefore, if I see the photon coming here, I know that for sure, if the only option was either to put a bomb here or not, I know for sure that the bomb was there. But remember, the photon never even get close to the bomb. So the photon sensed from a distance that there was a bomb here. This is why it's called an interaction-free measurement, okay? The photon was never, this bomb could be kilometers away. The photon never went this close to it, and nevertheless it knew that the bomb was there, all right? That's the first surprise. Now comes our friend Hardy, which is sitting here, I hope. Yes, he's there. And make a very interesting variation on this. He said the following, look, something much more exciting can happen here. Suppose I have two Mach Zehnders next to each other. And on this one, I send, say, electron. And in this one, I send a positron. I arrange it in such a way that if they go next to each other here, I can delay them if I like without losing the coherence. So I make sure that if they get close to each other here, they will necessarily annihilate each other. But now, because this situation, I added this situation, then if without this disturbance, I know that the electron necessarily would have gone in this way. But because the positron can now disturb it, I can find the electron actually going this way. And similarly, the positron that was necessarily coming in this way without the electron, I can find it coming in this way. So I send the electron, the positron, find the electron here and the positron there. And now I begin to wonder, what's going on here? I know that if the electron went here, something must have disturbed it. What could have disturbed it? The positron. So the positron must have gone here to disturb it, because if it went this way, the electron could never end up here. So I know for sure that by seeing the electron here, the positron must have gone this way. But now let's look at the positron. I know that the positron went this way. Something must have disturbed it. What could have disturbed it? Only the electron. So the electron must have gone this way in order to disturb the positron. But I know that they both couldn't have gone there because they would have annihilated each other. So this is the paradox. So now comes the usual answer. Again, you're wasting our time. You're talking about counterfactual things. You're talking about things that you don't measure. Never, never say this is impossible to think about it even. And indeed, if you say, if I would have looked only at the positron here, indeed I would find it there. But I couldn't anymore deduce that the electron was here because my measurement of the positron would disturb it, and therefore it could arrive here not because of the electron disturbance, but because of disturbance of my measurement. So therefore, again, it looks as if nothing is interesting here because we are thinking about counterfactual, and that's not interesting because we are not allowed to think about measurements that we can't do. But now comes again the interesting idea of weak measurement. Suppose I do a weak measurement on the electron. Indeed, I will find it here. Weak measurement on the positron, I will find it here. And nevertheless, a weak measurement of the pair will show that they were never together. How is it possible that the electron here, the positron is here, and they are never there together? It turns out that again, you have to learn to think in this new logical way that quantum mechanics is teaching you when you learn to think with weak values. There are four possible pairs of states. One pair of states is that the positron goes this way and the electron goes this way. Let's call this orbit 1, 2, and this is 1 and 2. So, for example, if I write 2, 2, let me do it this way, 2 times 2, that means that the positron went on this orbit and the electron went on this orbit. So this is one possible pair. Another possible pair is the electron went this way and the positron went this way. The third pair is the positron went this way and the electron went this way. And the fourth pair is that both of them are here together. This is not allowed because we say there would have been explosion otherwise. So we are left with three pairs. One pair, the positron was here and the electron was here. Another pair, the positron was here and the electron was here. If we look at these two pairs together, then we are sure that the positron went here and the electron went here, and they were not together. So what happens? The last pair that is left, which is the pair when the positron goes this way and the electron goes this way, has a negative value. So the total number of pairs is still one. And what does the negative value mean here? We have to look. When do we have in the Hamiltonian an interaction that depends on the product of the two projection operators and then get the opposite value? And the way to do it is to look at interaction between this and this. So for example, if I find some way to bring the two of this orbit and this orbit together and measure the interaction between them, instead of it being attractive as the usual interaction between electron and positron, it will be repulsive. So you see, quantum mechanics, if we listen to it carefully, if we learn to think carefully what it's trying to tell us, is opening for us beautiful new possibilities of thinking about things that we could not even imagine classically. You couldn't imagine classically a situation where electron goes here, positron, electron is in a given box for sure, and the positron is in the same box for sure, and they are never there together. And in fact, if you look at all the things that were exciting about quantum mechanics, all kinds of paradoxes, GHZ states, EPR states, if you look at all those things with using these new ideas and using pre and post selection, then you can see that in all of them, there is hidden new kind of phenomenon, of phenomena of the type that I'm discussing here. Okay, I will now, there are many, many more things that I can tell about it, but I don't have the time, so I will just tell you a little bit about possible generalization that are suggested by this new way of looking at quantum mechanics. The first straightforward generalization that is so intuitive, it simply begs itself to happen. Up to now, we say that a quantum system can be described by two vectors. And by the way, I call these two vectors the history vector and the destiny vector. The history vector is the vector that was defined by the measurement of the past, and the destiny vector that already exists here knows that it has to end up at this state. So up to now, I've discussed these two vectors by me making the selection from the outside. But suppose we do look now at the whole universe and we say that the whole universe still has to be described by one unbelievably complicated vector in Hilbert space. At least we know that the idea is at the beginning, one millionth of a second, the whole universe was in a quantum state. So let's say there is a quantum state, an initial quantum state for the whole universe. And now, suppose we say that even though there is no way to look from the outside on the universe, let's assume, because there is a freedom like this, let's ask the question, what happens if indeed we assume, and this is now a generalization, we assume that the whole universe is described by two vectors instead of one. What kind of new things can we find there? And the immediate answer is that the least that we can find is a solution to the collapse problem. Because in the usual picture, that if we don't assume collapse, we just use the many world picture, we know that each time we have a measurement, the world is split into a number of branches, including our brain, mind, when we look at it, very ugly picture. But anyhow, that's what quantum mechanics is telling us. So we have this tree that becomes more and more complicated, Now, suppose the state that comes from the future, the destiny state, just chooses one of these branches. I'm allowed to do that. Then I can show that consistently, although it's not trivial, that consistently this kind, there is a possible state that comes from the future, call it post-select, not a post-selected state, that's a bad name, but a destiny state. I can choose a destiny state that will indeed actually select for each measurement a single possible outcome, provided, and I find that it's necessary, provided the measuring device is sufficiently rich. It has many, many degrees of freedom. Otherwise, I could not do it. And there is an article on the net, I believe, by me and a student of mine. If you're interested, you should look at it. It's not a trivial thing, but it can be done. So this is one possible interesting generalization. The other thing is to ask, suppose indeed there are two vectors describing the whole universe, can we find some interesting outcome, even cosmological outcome, that will be different if we have two boundary conditions instead of one? I have some ideas of what can happen. It's too early to talk about it, but there are many interesting possibilities of choosing two boundary conditions that will not affect all the measurements that were done up to now. For example, it will be just things that will choose rare states, future state, just in the Planck scale or something like this. There are many possibilities that we are discussing now, a number of us, and there may be some eventually, some way to replace the thing that's now called the anthropic principle by actually a destiny state principle. And I think I will stop here. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Yahir. Questions?
Is it possible that this negative...
Can you speak louder? I can't hear you.
Is it possible that these negative particles could somehow account for the positive cosmological constant?
Of course, I'm thinking about it. That's one of the obvious initial ideas. You see, it's very easy, for example, let me show you the art of playing this game. Suppose I want to have pre and post selection of an harmonic oscillator that will give me a negative value for its energy. After all, any field that you take is just, forget about the nonlinearity, it's just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. So to get, for example, a negative effect instead of the usual positive fluctuation, to get negative fluctuation in the energy, I just have to show that I can have a pre and post selection on a single harmonic oscillator that will give me negative value, negative weak value for its energy. And that's very easy to do. And here's the art, how you start to think about it. If you have a state psi, the initial state psi 1, which is a negative state of operator A, such that this is equal to A times psi 1. And if you have the final state psi 2, is the negative state of an operator B, such that this is equal to B times psi 2. Then it's very trivial to show that the weak value for A plus B is equal simply to A plus B. That's trivial. You can calculate it immediately. So now we know, for example, suppose I choose the initial state, psi 1, for an harmonic oscillator, to be a negative state of the state x minus x1 square plus p square is equal to the this times that, say over 2, is equal to 1/2 times psi 1. So it's a shifted ground state. And suppose I choose x minus the final state, x minus x2 square plus p square is equal to 1/2. So, let me think for a minute. I told you it's very simple. You know that there is a story about, I think it was von Neumann, was at Princeton teaching his students, and he always gave them very complicated problems to solve at all. One time he gave them such a hard problem that they came back and said, no way, we could not solve it at all. He said, it must be very simple. He said, no, no, we could not solve it. Then he started to look at that and say, oh, 1 minute. He left the room, went to his office, stayed there for half an hour, came back and said, yes, it's very simple, and still did not tell them the answer. So I'm telling you this is very simple, but now I'm confused for a minute. So let me think about it. Just 1 minute. Ah, yeah. Yes, it's very simple. Okay, so yeah. Okay, so let me choose x minus x1 square plus p square over 2 is equal to 1/2 for the initial state, and x plus x1 square over 2 plus p square over 2 is equal to 1/2 for the final state. So this is A and this is B. So we know that if we look at the sum of these two operators, the weak value of the sum of these two operators will be A plus B, which is 1. So what is the sum of these two operators? It's x squared plus p squared plus x1 squared, 2 times x1 squared, or 2 times all of them. Okay, forget about the 2. P squared plus P squared plus X1 squared is equal to 1. That means that X squared plus P squared is equal to 1 minus X1 squared, and X1 can be as big as I like, so you get a negative value for the weak value of the energy. So this shows you how you can begin to play with boundary conditions and get anything interesting that you like. So if I would choose for normal mode, say, of a gravitational field or even electromagnetic field, but of very high frequencies, so that they are not affecting the lamp shift, they are not affecting anything that was done up to now in the laboratory. If I choose for them boundary conditions to give me negative contribution to the energy of the vacuum, I can play around and get things that have to do with exactly the cosmological constant. So this is the type of games I'm trying to play, but I'm not willing yet to say that I can find something that will give just a meaningful answer and also will lead to other interesting experimental consequences. But there is hope that it can be done. Any other questions? Yes.
Yes, Professor. So I have to take issue with the interpretation of what you've done. Obviously, the mathematics is fine. I've seen it before. But yeah. It relates to the realism of the wave function, in the sense that you said that many worlds is what quantum mechanics leads us to. I don't think that's at all required. But that's sort of background to what I'm going to say next, which is more concrete, which has to do with your three boxes proposal.
Okay, yeah.
And it seemed like you were saying that you could actually test this and see a macroscopic movement of a test charge. And is it not true that that would always be washed out by the uncertainty in your pointer, because you're requiring that the measurement be weak?
No, but the interaction with each individual one is weak, but the interaction with the n of them is robust. I said if I have a pre and post selected rare ensemble, there are n particles, actually n particles in this box, large n particles here and minus n here, the interaction of my test particle with each one of them is weak, and therefore it exactly answered the condition that I described initially when I measured this A total. Instead, I can do the measurement on each individual case just by a single measuring device. Indeed, in that case, the change in the measuring device in each individual case will be much less than uncertainty, but when I collect all of them, I will find exactly the same answer.
So then, just a quick follow-up. Are you saying that you can actually prepare states that have these weird properties? Because to me, it seems like the post-selection requires that you only look back and say, oh, well, if we discard all the other results, then those showed this weird phenomenon. even though the whole ensemble does not.
Then you have missed what I've proven. I've proven that, first of all, as long as the pre-selected state is not orthogonal to the post-selected state, I can do this pre- and post-selection and look at these exclusive experiments. And then I've shown that when I do this pre- and post-selection, and I do a weak coupling in the middle, I will get these weak values. And by the way,
I did understand that, by the way. Continue.
So please. If you don't understand, then let's discuss it privately later.
Okay, no problem.
Okay. By the way, I was asked to give another kind of, to have another kind of meeting on Friday with those of you that are the postdoctoral students here. Maybe you can announce it. You know what I'm talking about? This meeting on Friday, where we'll have opportunity to discuss this more.
I should say Yakir is not only a distinguished research chair here at Perimeter Institute, he's also a patron of the Perimeter Scholars International Master's Program, which started this year. And so for the PSI students in the audience, he's going to be speaking to the PSI students tomorrow, I believe, at 2:30.
Yeah, that will be on Friday. So if any of you, I don't know if it's open to the public or not, but we can discuss something more. Let me just mention one thing before I forget. There are some articles that are appearing now when people claim that these weak values are not unique, because you can find other type of measuring arrangement that the system will be disturbed very little and you will get something different from weak values. The answer is that the weak values are unique, and you see it by discussing a much more general question than just measurement. Suppose I have two quantum particles that the first one is described by H1, the second is described by the Hamiltonian H2, and there is a coupling V of 1 and 2 between them. This can be two particles, two quantum systems, it doesn't matter. Suppose this coupling is weak, and we are allowed to look only at the effect of it to first order in lambda. Then it turns out that if I do pre- and post-selection on particle 1, then particle 2 will experience the weak value of this potential as a function of time. Namely, if I find, suppose this is the initial state psi 1 for particle 1, and this is the final state psi 1 prime for particle 1, then because I'm interested only up to first order in lambda on the effect on 2, then I can calculate for 1 the evolution without the effect of lambda. Otherwise, it will be lambda squared. So I have here the two vectors, psi 1 and psi 1 prime, that evolve backwards and forwards in time according to H1. Using these two vectors as a function of time, I can define V weak of 2 as psi 1 prime of t, V psi 1 of t, divided by psi 1 prime psi 1. This gives me now a function of 2, which is a function of time. It's indeed a weak value, and this is unique. There is no ambiguity here. So the idea is that weak values don't appear only in measurement. They are a general feature of any two quantum system that interacts weakly with each other. The effective potential that each one of them sees, if I do a pre- and post-selection on the other, will be the weak value of this potential. So measurement is just a special case of interaction. So that's how, for measurement, this appears also. But this weak value is a much more general concept, and it's unique. There is no ambiguity in that. Any other question? Yes.
Maybe one final question.
Say that this point of view gets rid of the collapsed postulate, and I agree, but it seems to me it replaces it by another necessity for a postulate, a compatibility postulate. That is to say, the final state vector has to be in some way compatible with the initial state vector. For example, if you start out with an initial state, which is an apparatus at a particular location and a particle, which it then measures, and the final state, I don't have any rules, so I will put the apparatus in another room.
Of course, there's no
way that it could have gotten to the other room. The only way I could understand what my limited set of final states would be to follow the Hamiltonian evolution of the system forward and come up with various possibilities and by the collapsed postulate, and then say, oh, one of these could be the final state. So, you understand my problem.
Yeah, well, first of all, the compatibility I don't worry about, because the thing that you're describing, when I know that the particle is given room, it still have always a very weak tails everywhere outside, and therefore, if I post-selected someplace else, it seems that I discovered an extremely rare situation, and it will give me extremely interesting results. It's never the scalar product is never, there is never in quantum mechanics no incompatibility, because always there is tails, a particle is never in a given eigenstate of energy, there are always perturbation. You don't have to worry about compatibility. And on the other hand, what I said about the collapse, I think this, you have to read this article. I did not have time to go into all the details, but it's a meaningful statement.
Well, I would worry about it because one would want to make a fundamental theory out of this and apply it to the universe as a whole, or at least a large, very large portion of the universe. And then if you don't worry about it because any state vector that you chose as a final state vector would be quite interesting, it would be quite interesting, but it would also give a history for us of very unusual things happening all during the universe. It would only be a rather limited set of final states that one could choose, which would give the kind of universe that we see.
That's why I said that the type of, you're right, I said that the freedom that I have with this future boundary condition is only in regions where experiments have not been done so far, say ultraviolet, you know, Planck scale frequencies, etc. In all the other regions, I will choose the post-selection that will give me just the usual weak values that I see today. So of course, I don't have freedom to assume that the future boundary condition is arbitrary, because they make all the time experiments that test, from my point of view, test what is the destiny state all the time. Okay, but we can talk more about it separately. You're very quiet all the time. Are you agree with me completely, or you say that it's so hopeless that you don't want to say anything? More interesting. Oh, good. Yeah. Okay. Well, we will meet next time. I want these meetings to happen sufficiently often that eventually you will be completely convinced, right? Each time weekly, but it becomes strongly. It's not the cemetery, yeah. Sorry? Yeah, there is a small piece that looks the same, but a large piece is very different, yeah. But there is a large piece that's very different. In fact, yeah. Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you see, very quickly, the problem is that for most of my boundary condition, he runs into what he calls inconsistent histories, and therefore they claim it doesn't make sense. But since it does make sense, it means that their condition for what makes sense or not doesn't make sense. Yeah, okay. What's that? Okay, we should talk about it some more. Is this, I think that's the end?
Yes,
okay, thank you very much for listening to me. So
let's thank Shakir again.